Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 379, titled Between Iraq and a Hard Place, Part 2. This is being recorded on September 22nd of 2002. If listeners find the very pedantic format that I use on this broadcast difficult, or if people would like to follow up on some of the references, be aware that within a week or so of the recording of this program, there will be a detailed, annotated description, including sources and, in many cases, text excerpts for the Record 379. That will be in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. That website is also equipped with real audio. Be aware, too, that sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, is archiving the For the Record programs on real audio. More recent programs streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older programs are available for download only at a longer URL linked to both the Spitfire website and the wfmu.org/Dave Emery website. More about this later in the program. As I'm speaking on September 22nd of 2002, much of the journalistic coverage over the past couple of months, not only in the United States but elsewhere, has been devoted to speculation, not at all surprising in light of some of the pronouncements of U.S. officialdom, concerning the possibility of war between the United States and Iraq. This ostensibly turns on the issue of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, primarily its development of nuclear weapons. As I mentioned in For the Record Program 374, Between Iraq and a Hard Place, Part 1, there were a number of articles in the U.S. media speculating about a meeting that George Bush, that's George W. Bush, George II as I call him, had with officials, and a scenario was presented vis-a-vis Iraq that was described as being potentially far more destructive than September 11th, and this was what was alleged to be behind George Bush's determination to go to war with Iraq. I think that much of the commentary about wagging the dog is on the money. This is not to say that there may not be reason to go to war with Iraq, but I do think that a primary interest on the part of this administration is to deflect away from a number of very, very significant domestic problems ranging from the economy, corporate scandals, questions about what the administration knew about September 11th. And I think that, for example, recent comments by German officials in this regard were not all that far from the mark. This is not to say that I endorse the German stance vis-a-vis Iraq or September 11th, but simply in passing, because we're going to deal with a different issue, simply in passing, I want to note that I think that people who have speculated about the administration being anxious to deflect from domestic issues, and there have been quite a few of those, even Republican leaders who have been quite candid about the way the Iraq issue is pushing domestic bread-and-butter issues out of the 2002 campaign, I think there is much substance to that line of inquiry. However, and of course, there's also the whole question of oil. Iraq, of course, is a major oil producer. We have a president and vice president in the oil business, and the oil business, as they call it in Texas, certainly is a major consideration vis-a-vis Iraq. I would bring to mind for the listeners many of the programs, including the most recent half-hour segment, For the Record 378, talking about the concept of the Earth Island geopolitics and the macroeconomic and macro-political maneuvering between the United States, the Arab oil-producing nations, and other Muslim oil-producing nations, and Europe, in particular the possibility that the oil wealth from the Middle East could be denominated in euros and switched to European banks, thereby signaling a profound shift in world economic and political power. However, in this program, like in Iraq, Between Iraq and a Hard Place, Part 1, number 374, one of the questions that I think needs to be asked and answered, and that concerns the possibility, And note that this is speculative, the possibility that, in fact, biological weapons may have been used by Iraq, or certainly are potential of potential use by Iraq, and that perhaps some of them have already been used, and that this might, in fact, be being used to lure the United States into a confrontation. I am concerned that the U.S. may be falling into a trap, a PR trap, among other things. More about that in future broadcasts when I'm going to discuss the issue of conspiracy theory and September 11th, because I think the very concept of conspiracy theory has entered into the events in and around the Middle East in a big way. We'll touch on that in the near the end of the program. In For the Record program number 295 and in number 374, I talked about the fact that Iraq had apparently developed foot and mouth disease as a biological warfare weapon, that the outbreak that took place in the United Kingdom in the spring of 2001 was unusual in that it was a type of foot and mouth disease unknown outside of the Middle East and Southwest Asia. And I asked the question about whether perhaps this might have constituted an Iraqi response to some of the air raids that had taken place, Anglo-American air raids on its territory. And I also speculated about the possibility that this may be at least one of the factors that we are not being told about and that may in fact be motivating this administration in the direction of military action against Iraq, which, if that were in fact the case, I say if, and if a convincing case could be made in that regard, I think it would warrant a military response. In that context, consider the following. This is an article from the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, September 20th of 2002. This is an article by Tom Abate. I think that's how it's pronounced, A-B-A-T-E. It's headlined, U.S. Not Ready for Agro-Terrorism, Report Finds. The article reads in part as follows. In a report so sensitive that an entire chapter was removed before publication, a panel of government scientists said Thursday that the United States was ill-prepared to detect and contain potential bioterror attacks on the nation's agricultural system. The National Research Council report, Containing Agricultural Terrorism, unquote, offers no guess about how likely it is that terrorists might try to infect crops or animals with insect, bacterial, or viral pests. But Committee Chairman Harley Moon, an Iowa State University veterinarian, said the 12-member panel painted such a detailed picture of the weak spots on U.S. farms that the Department of Agriculture had asked that the entire chapter on threats be removed. Quote, "We don't want to provide a blueprint for terror," Moon said, again quoting, "We want to show how to build upon our current systems for containing natural pest incursions in case we face a deliberate terrorist introduction," unquote. Moon said a potential terrorist attack could undermine public confidence in U.S. agricultural products, and even if it posed only a limited danger to human life, it could cause enormous economic disruptions. Also, I would add political instability and the foot-and-mouth outbreak in Britain, whether or not it was an incident of bioterrorism, certainly didn't do Tony Blair or the United Kingdom's economy any good. Skipping ahead in this article, the common theme running through California's proactive response and the somber National Research Council report is that the best way to defend U.S. farms against potential terror is to beef up the systems already in place to keep foreign pests from accidentally contaminating crops or farm animals. I would add parenthetically a terrible unintentional pun there. The best way to defend against terror is to beef up the systems already in place. Continuing here, for instance, when foot and mouth disease broke out in the United Kingdom in 2001, California State veterinarian Richard Breitmeyer is credited with instituting measures that protected the state's cattle and dairy industries. Skipping down still further, "When we started, this was something we thought of as a distant future threat," Moon said, adding that, again quoting, "September 11th told us on the committee that the clock we had in our minds might not be advanced enough." And again, one of the questions that I have concerning the saber rattling in the direction of Iraq is whether perhaps Saddam Hussein, not the fool that he is being made out to be, might perhaps be drawing the United States into a geopolitical trap of sorts in which covert means may be being used to provoke the United States and Britain, and that unless there can be a credible overt demonstration of a need to go to war, Saddam Hussein could win the PR battle, with the aid, I would add, of a lot of unwilling or unwitting assistants, not only in the United States and elsewhere, those assistants being people who have not asked and answered the proper questions. More about Iraq's possible development of foot-and-mouth disease. And again, the Financial Times reported that the UN had mentioned that foot-and-mouth had been developed by Iraq. And again, the strain that broke out in the United Kingdom was the South Asian strain, native to the Middle East and Southwest Asia, never before seen in Europe. Another Financial Times article from Tuesday, September 10th of 2002, deals with the issue of biological warfare weapons. It's called Deadly Agents Difficult to Defend Against. And skipping down about Iraq, it says, it has continued to develop a foot-and-mouth disease vaccine plant at Daura, D-A-U-R-A, which had produced botulinum toxin and anthrax. I've noted in the past that the conceptual dividing line between offensive and defensive biological weapons is largely arbitrary. When one learns to manipulate the infectious qualities of a pathogen, usually the research for defense and offense is pretty much the same. And again, the UN had reported in the past that foot and mouth disease was being developed by Iraq. I would also note that as we saw in For the Record 374, the Iraqi Biological Warfare Weapons Program was originally called the General Directorate of Veterinary Affairs and was overseen by Saddam Hussein's uncle and political mentor, Khairullah al-Tufa, who in turn was a supporter of the pro-Nazi uprising led by Ali Rashid and instigated by the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem in 1941. We took a look at that in, among other programs, 369. And I would note that foot and mouth disease, like anthrax and like a number of other diseases, is of course native to animals, in this case cattle. It can also affect humans. I would note also in this regard, considering that General Directorate of Veterinary Affairs is what the Iraqi weapons program is called, I would note that a number of other organisms provided to Iraq are also things that can infect agricultural production, specifically cattle. An article by author William Blum was published in the Progressive magazine in 1998. This is called Anthrax for Export, subtitled U.S. Companies Sold Iraq the Ingredients for a Witch's Brew. This was published by the Progressive in April of 1998. It's available on their website at www.progressive.org. The full URL will be in the description for 379 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. Talking about the infectious organisms that have been given to Iraq, skipping down, the author writes, also on the list, Escherichia coli, or E. coli, genetic materials, human and bacterial DNA, and others and dozens of other pathogenic biological agents. Quote, these biological materials were not attenuated or weakened and were capable of reproduction, the Senate report said. It was later learned that these microorganisms exported by the United States were identical to those the United Nations inspectors found and removed from the Iraqi Biological Warfare Program. As we've looked at in numerous programs, including For the Record 347, the arming of Iraq in the 1980s in order to fight against Iran was accomplished largely through the networks that were set up and were supervised by the elder George Bush when he was vice president. And considering the role of the United States in helping to give Saddam Hussein some of his biological warfare capability, one wonders about the possibility of Saddam Hussein using this basically as political leverage, basically blackmail in effect, in order to affect the policies of the younger George Bush, who has in many ways reinstituted many of the people who were advisors to his father's administration. That is by way of speculation, but I've always suspected there was more to the calling a halt to the U.S. troops who could have easily removed Saddam Hussein than we have been told. The elder George Bush was known to have favored using Saddam as something of a counterweight to Israel and a sort of a threat to keep Israel in line. I wonder to what extent Saddam Hussein or some of the other Arab countries, perhaps Saudi Arabia, basically dragged out the issue of the elder George Bush's culpability in arming Iraq and basically said, in effect, hold it, bub, or we're going to make this public. Again, I wonder about the elder George Bush, his role in arming Iraq. I wonder about Gulf War Syndrome, the research that we've looked at as done by Garth Nicholson, Dr. Garth Nicholson, who demonstrated that some of the Gulf War Syndrome stems from an infectious microorganism called a mycoplasma, which in turn has been genetically altered with a gene from the AIDS virus to make it more pathogenic. And it appears that that organism was given to Saddam Hussein, who then put it into some airburst scuds. That organism has now infected some of the troops who served in Gulf War, and in turn, that has been communicated to some of their relatives and also caregivers. Happily, the mycoplasma is easily treatable by a cycle of antibiotics, but of course that is predicated upon the correct identification of that of the infectious agent. But again, the elder George Bush, his role in helping to arm Iraq, and in particular giving it some of its BW capabilities, is something to consider. Now, returning to the issue of E. coli, which William Blum alleges was given to Saddam Hussein in part by the United States, of course, E. coli, like foot and mouth disease and like anthrax, is a disease that is native to cattle, and indeed the careless processing of beef can result in E. coli contamination, all of which in the era of deregulation that we exist in could make things very complicated indeed, with E. coli, according to the article in The Progressive, allegedly having been stockpiled by Saddam Hussein, with E. coli being an infection that can take place simply through careless food processing. How is one necessarily to know? Consider the following, a recent article. This is from the website of Channel 7, the ABC affiliate in Denver, Colorado. This was posted on Monday, July 1st of 2002. It's Dateline Denver headline, ConAgra recalls ground beef. Subtitle, worries about E. coli prompt recall of 354,000 pounds of beef. This article reads in part as follows. A warning before you pack your lunch today. ConAgra Beef Company of Greeley, Colorado is voluntarily recalling approximately 354,200 pounds of fresh and frozen ground beef products that may be contaminated with E. coli bacteria, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Food Safety and Inspection Service announced Sunday. Now, again, I don't want to be misunderstood as claiming that this is an incident of terrorism. Again, one of the things that makes this a sticky wicket is the fact that E. coli is an infection that takes place when beef is carelessly processed. And with, again, a lot of deregulatory pressure to take away these pesky regulations which impede production, blah, 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 part of the mantra of deregulation, one of the questions we have to ask about E. coli is basically, is it live or is it Memorex, so to speak? ConAgra is also an interesting company. It was actually bought out by an American firm, but it was begun, as we looked at in For the Record 305 and again in For the Record 320. It was begun in Germany by an SS veteran of the Holocaust, utilizing funds that were looted from Holocaust victims, later sold to an American company, but usually when the Bormann organization, the economic component of a Third Reich gone underground, does a deal, it usually keeps its fingers in some way. This is not to be misunderstood as charging that ConAgra's E. coli contamination was deliberate, but as we keep an eye out, I think we have to be aware that we are vulnerable to this type of thing, and I think we need to think critically and ask the important questions about phenomena that might not otherwise arouse our interest. Now, in that same context, bearing in mind that the Iraqi Biological Warfare Weapons Program was called the General Directorate of Veterinary Affairs, bearing in mind the elder George Bush's role in helping to give them some of their wee beasties, and also bearing in mind the saber-rattling now going on. And again, I think that distracting from domestic problems, something the Republican congressional leadership has been fairly candid about in some articles, is a valid consideration. Obviously, also, we have an oil man as president, an oil man as vice president, and the all business is what it's all about in the Middle East. That is obviously another factor vis-a-vis U.S. policy there. I wonder to what extent we may be being baited into a move that could have unforeseen repercussions, either economic or perhaps leading to a shift in the evaluation of petroleum in euros instead of dollars. That would have a serious effect on the U.S. economy. As I'm speaking, on September 22nd of 2002, we have another infection that is spreading its way throughout the United States. This is the West Nile fever virus, which is being spread by mosquitoes. Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont has raised a question about the West Nile epidemic that was alluded to in the San Jose Mercury News of Friday, September 13th of 2002. In the Nation in Brief section, we find the following. This is headline, Senator asks if terror is linked to West Nile virus. Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont, said Thursday that the authorities should examine whether the spread of the West Nile virus in this country is a result of biological terrorism. Is it a coincidence that we are seeing such an increase in West Nile virus? Or is it that something is being tested as a biological weapon against us? Leahy, chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, said in a radio interview in Waterbury. Again, quoting, there are some people, credibly, who feel that it is a test of our defenses and is a biological weapon or somebody doing this for commercial purposes, unquote. Well, I think that's a worthwhile question to ask. I want to stress that I do not have an answer to that, but I wonder about the West Nile fever virus and the epidemic now coursing its way across the United States, and I also wonder about the possibility, and again, as was the case with 374, this is an interrogatory element, I wonder about the possibility of this having a terror-related source, and one of the possibilities in that regard might be Iraq, and take into consideration the following allegation. We're going to turn to the book, In the Name of Osama Bin Laden, subtitled Global Terrorism and the Bin Laden Brotherhood. This was authored by Roland Jacquard, published in softcover by Duke University Press, copyright 2002. And this is the paperback edition, ISBN number 0-8223-2991-3. This is the paperback edition. There's also a cloth-bound edition. Now, one of the things that may have spurred Senator Leahy's inquiries concerning the West Nile fever virus is an allegation by an Iraqi defector that Iraq had developed a variant of the West Nile fever virus as a biological warfare weapon. Turning to Ronan Jacquard's In the Name of Osama Bin Laden, we read, an incident that occurred in New York in August of 1999 and which has continued through the present is a good indication of what a terrorist threat of this kind might be like. It was the episode of the West Nile virus, which began to create panic in New York health services after 5 deaths had occurred. Amplified by the media, the epidemic was even characterized on several occasions as a terrorist attack on the basis of information from several security services. According to researchers, the symptoms of infection by the West Nile virus are a slight fever and nausea lasting for 3 to 6 days, and the infecting agents are mosquitoes. In children and people with a weakened immune system, such as those who are HIV positive, the West Nile virus can cause fatal encephalitis. The virus is not a newcomer either. It has a place in the history of virology. It was discovered in 1937 in the West Nile district of Uganda. Carried by mosquitoes and birds, the virus is a great traveler. Following the seasonal migration of birds to Europe, some strains have been found in Volgograd and Rostov-on-Don, of course, both of those in the former Soviet Union. The virus made its first appearance in New York in August of 1999, but no one knows what vehicle it used to cross the Atlantic. Considering the date at which the first infected patients appeared, experts think that the infecting agent, perhaps a bird traveling on a freighter, arrived in late June or early July in northern Queens and southern Bronx. In support of this hypothesis, a curious phenomenon occurred in the area around the Bronx Zoo. Around the middle of August, dozens of crows, clearly suffering from neurological disturbances and the loss of spatial orientation, could no longer fly and crash to the ground. Autopsies led experts to conclude that they had died from encephalitis. In the following days, the epidemic struck cormorants, flamingos, and eagles in and around the Bronx. And at the same time, two elderly people died from a strange encephalitis caused by a still unknown virus in a Queens hospital a few miles away. The brain samples from the two victims analyzed by the experts of the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta demonstrated, after a first misidentification as St. Louis virus, that it was in reality a virus close to the West Nile virus that had caused the carnage among birds. Mayor Rudolph Giuliani then had helicopters spray tons of insecticide over Queens. According to municipal authorities, almost all American stocks of insecticides were used up by the city of New York in a few days, more than a million containers. The New York epidemic again raised the question of the ability of the health services to respond to a bacteriological threat. In this particular case, the reaction was satisfactory, but the threat was on a small scale. Several American intelligence agents had already informed the White House of a plan by Saddam Hussein that they had learned of a few months earlier from a renegade in direct contact with the dictator. According to the source, Saddam Hussein had triumphantly announced to him in one of his secret offices in Baghdad that he had given orders to develop a biological weapon using strain SV1417 of the West Nile virus in April of 1999, and that he planned to use it against a target known to himself alone. Well, again, I'm wondering about the West Nile virus, about the rumination engaged in by Senator Leahy. And obviously, I'm wondering if perhaps this is what really underlies the war fever and the saber rattling in the direction of Iraq. I would note in that regard the question of the dissemination of propaganda and, again, the Nazi Islamist influence in that part of the world that we've talked about at great length, including in, for the record, 378. And by way of a point of departure, something that we will take up at in future broadcasts is the whole issue of propaganda, psychological warfare, and conspiracy theory vis-a-vis the events of September 11th. By the way, I will be moving on to other subjects, but I believe that the events in and around September 11th constitute the coming to fruition of most of the events of the 20th century and may very well prove decisive for life for Americans in the 21st century, hence the attention that I've been giving it. We're going to conclude with a look at the Financial Times of Wednesday, August 7th of 2002. This is an op-ed column in the Financial Times by Sir Michael Quinlan. It's headlined, War on Iraq, a Blunder and a Crime. And it has this following rumination. A majority of people polled in a recent survey of opinion on the Arab street believe that a Zionist conspiracy was behind the September 11th attacks. Given such sentiment, it would be naive to assume that a U.S.-led overthrow of Mr. Hussein would be hailed with general relief. And there remains the problem of governing Iraq afterwards. Claims about viable regimes in waiting, especially ones likely both to please the U.S. and to enjoy popular support, carry little conviction. And again, the notion that the Jews were behind September 11th is something that I've actually encountered in the United States as well. This is not a conspiracy theory limited to the Arab street. The American left has been engaging in quite a bit of that, and that should give a lot of people pause to think. There will be a detailed annotated description of For the Record program number 379 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website within a week of the recording of this program, namely this being recorded on September 22nd of 2002. You will find that description in the Real Audio Equipped Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recently, programs at wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word. Older broadcasts at a URL that is linked to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website and to the other WFMU website. Radio stations will get the For the Record program for free from Spitfire. They should contact Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. This concludes For the Record 379, Between a Rock and a Hard Place, Part 2, being recorded on September 22nd of 2002. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.